I have a dream.
One small step.
How many we say
the wall must go.
Diner, Princess of Wales.
Right into the World Trade Center.
Winner is Sydney.
This week in history.
Well, tonight for This Week in History, we are going to May 16, 1771, and a field on the bank of the Alamance Creek in North Carolina. Rebellion had been brewing in the British colony for years. Poor farmers on the western outskirts were growing frustrated with the heavy taxes and corruption among the ruling elite, and the regulator movement sprung up to push for change. But when their demands were ignored, and that frustration spilled over into violence. What happened next is known as the Battle of Alamance, and it's seen by many as a warning and a stepping stone on the way to the American War of Independence. To take us through what happened, I'm joined by Dr. Kit Candlin, historian of American history at the University of Newcastle. Dr. Candlin, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so this is the late 1760s, early 1770s. Can you paint a picture of North America at this time? How much has been colonized and who is in control?
Okay. We understand North America as 13 colonies, all bubbling away there in the 1760s. But there are actually a lot of colonies in the Americas that the British were after or controlled, including the West Indies and Northeastern Canada. But the 13 colonies in the middle were particularly special. They were very different, these different 13 colonies, but in a sense, they were next to each other and they had communication and trade with one another. So there was a lot joining them together, if you like. But there were lots of complaints and protests up and down the 13 colonies for all kinds of different reasons. I think America, at this time, being just the eastern seaboard there, you've got as a protest movement that begins with efforts by the British Crown to tax these North American colonies, in a sense, to pay for their defense and to try and rein in and bring some control to the British Empire, because it had been growing very quickly, especially in North America since the early 18th century, and indeed before as well. But things had picked up speed, especially with the war with France, or the wider Seven Years' War. And it was felt that the North American colonists should pay, in a sense, for their own defense and more taxes. But this is an interesting conundrum, because we often think, because of the patriotism and the nationalist sentiment, that this is plucky colonists fighting against the big bad empire. We have to sort of see really this emerging struggle between the British colonies, or these particular ones, and Britain, as a kind of developing civil war in the British Empire about who would govern it and how it would be governed. It's ironic, because the American colonists were, this in the 1760s, some of the least taxed people in the British Empire. They were healthier generally than other people in Britain or in the British Empire. They were on average wealthier, and they were better educated than most people.
Oh, really?
In Britain. Education in the colonies was quite high. It's about 80%. Whereas in Britain, it was somewhere between 40 and 60, depending on where you went. So they were more literate as well. And of course, with literacy comes newspapers, and all of that was in the air as well. We have to remember also that there's an awful lot of loyalists in North America. And it's certainly in the 1760s, it wasn't clear that a lot of people wanted to break away. In fact, it wouldn't have looked like that at all. A lot of that is nationalist sentiment that's come afterwards to create this titanic struggle. But it was actually, in terms of revolutionary movements, it wasn't really a revolution. So I like to call it the American War of Independence, like many people, because it was really a conservative revolt, in that they wanted to keep power flowing the same way it had been before the Seven Years' War. In a sense, there's a lot of libertarian feeling there. But they really wanted to remain under the same structure that had brought some of them so much wealth. I mean, the early Congress was dominated by big planter interests who owned a lot of slaves. And so in a sense, that was the conservative edge that won out in this rebellion against the British Crown.
So although there are many nuances to it, and academics like yourself, I'm sure, could bring them out, but in an essence, it's about Americans saying, we don't want to pay taxes without representation in Westminster, and the British saying, well, a lot of the Westminster funds go to the defence of the colonies, so it's only fair that you pay taxes to ensure that that defence can be kept up.
Well, in a sense, but they also stopped short of that, and they just said, look, this is the prerogative of Parliament to determine what goes on. We won't respond to argument or rebellion. That was the final word, if you like, rather than a bargain or a deal. But we also have to see it as there are all kinds of different reasons why Americans, and many of them wouldn't really necessarily call themselves American in a nationalistic sense at this stage. But there were many reasons why people struggled with new regulations and new taxes. It was, you know, so for example, big planters were worried that the British government might end slavery, and they were worried that that might happen. You didn't like quartering British redcoats in your house for nothing. If you were a merchant, you didn't like the mercantilist system, which told you where you had to sell your goods. If you were a backwoodsman, like a Scots or Irishman that are involved with the regulator movement, you know, you wanted to expand into Indian land and the British government was stopping you doing that. And of course, if you were a Protestant dissenter, you didn't like the threat of the Church of England taking over religion across the colonies. You wanted to keep religion free for white Protestants. As part of the dissenting tradition. So there were lots of different reasons why Americans found contestation, at least, with the British government. And it was a kind of unification of all of these factors and the British poor performance during the war itself that led to independence and a unifying spirit.
Okay, well, so that's the wider picture on the move towards independence. We're focusing today on the North Carolina colony.
Yeah.
What was life like in North Carolina compared to some of the, especially more northern colonies?
Yeah, okay. Well, all the colonies had a different flavor to them, if you like. And North Carolina and South Carolina and Georgia are the southern three states. On the coasts and up the rivers, they've got plantations with slaves. There are huge populations moving into this territory now. Many thousands of people are moving in to take land that's free or very cheap. So there's a lot of big planters and they have a lot of slaves. But having said that, there's also a bracket of yeoman farmers, settlers. They own very few slaves, if at all. And they tend to congregate on the coast as well. But further inland, you've got much poorer people. Some of these Scots and Irish backwoodsmen, we call them, living right out on the frontier, right inside the interior, right up against Native Americans, or even indeed amongst them. And they're often quite poor, and they form the foot soldiers for the regulator movement, if you like, because it's all about these poor people in the western part of North Carolina who are put upon by the government. They pay high taxes, often for nefarious reasons. They have to put up with a lot of corruption and nepotism. They're overregulated and underrepresented. And also the courts work against them as well. So these poorer people, there's an element of some people used to talk about a kind of class division, but it certainly was there. There was generally this impression that the regulators were often lawless frontier people, and the more settled people on the coasts really didn't like the regulators. But nevertheless, they were called regulators because they wanted to regulate the government and make it fairer. They wanted to stamp out all of these things like corruption and the courts and the surveyors and all kinds of government officials, and they felt hard done by. And so they wanted to regulate the government. They protested in 1767, and then in 1768, they actually marched to the regional capital of Hillsborough, to the courthouse there, and they smashed up the courtroom. They even dug up a body of a dead slave and put the remains on the speaker's chair. Oh, no, they put excrement on the speaker's chair and put this dug-up dead slave where the mace would be.
Oh, God.
In courtroom. Yeah, I mean, it was quite gruesome. But it was a very violent society. I mean, the enslaved people were kept in check by immense violence and cruelty, great cruelty as well. I mean, it was worse in the Caribbean. It was far worse in the Caribbean. One of the interesting things about American enslavement is that enslaved people in America self-replicated because conditions were easier. But nevertheless, North and South Carolina and Georgia were pretty rough places to be enslaved.
And how did the regulators coalesce into a force that would eventually become a violent force?
Yeah, okay. Well, the regulators were part of this social group, if you like. So they had connections like that. And what they did is they found common cause around 1865 with the Stamp Act. This was the first big new tax that the British government, it was a tax on paper. Now, it really didn't affect the people who would be regulators because they didn't use a lot of official papers at all because they were poor frontiers people. But nevertheless, across the colonies, people started to complain about government, if you like. So it was in this atmosphere that the regulators started to gather together in meetings to talk about how oppressed they were. And gradually this movement in 1765, 66 and 67 has more meetings. There are petitions, there are protests, people are beaten up, various government officials are beaten up, isolated incidents all around central and western North Carolina. And then in 1768, a large group, as I said, moves on to the courthouse in Hillsborough and smashes it all up. So that's really how they sort of gathered together. And the courthouse in 1768 was a major event for the regulators, and it was a precursor to this battle that we're about to talk about.
Well, the ringleader was a guy named Herman Husband. Who was he, and how did he get at the front of this regulator movement?
Well, he would confess that he wasn't really the leader, but he is one of the names that emerges at this time as being particularly vocal. He was an itinerant preacher, and for a long time he was a Quaker, although he left the Quaker faith just before the regulator movement. But nevertheless, he was a charismatic speaker and a preacher as well. He also taught. And he was, as I said, itinerant, so he moved around the place a lot. And he got behind various protest movements. He managed to escape the aftermath of the Battle of Alamance and make it up to Virginia, where he hid under a different name. And eventually he got himself involved in the Whiskey Rebellion, which was another rebellion about tax, this time on whiskey. But this time after America had declared its independence. So that was Herman Husband. Just before this battle, he actually rode away because his Quaker faith at the time, or his Quaker belief system, didn't allow him to suffer violence in any way.
So after this storming of the Hillsborough Courthouse that you've mentioned, this violent event, the then governor of North Carolina, a guy named William Tryon, did he respond with force immediately?
Look, yeah, Tryon's an interesting character. He'd married into money and a little bit of nepotism and a little bit of what we would call corruption today, but he managed to get himself the governorship of North Carolina. He was a successful soldier in the Seven Years' War, an officer. He'd reached the rank of general, or he would reach lieutenant general. And he was governor of North Carolina. He became known a little bit later when he was made governor of New York for being very heavy-handed, and he was sort of relieved of command when he was the governor of New York. because he violently pushed sort of suspected loyalists, if you like. That was the problem. He was upsetting loyalists around New York by burning people out of their homes that he thought were patriots, but the British government thought they may be loyalists. So he was seen as being a bit too heavy-handed. But during the Regulator movement, when he's the governor of North Carolina, he is tentative at first. So the courthouse becomes a major event. He arrives with the militia that he's raised. And the regulators move back and things quieten down for about a year. But nevertheless, Tryon spends a lot of money building himself a brand new mansion, Tryon Palace, and there is a direct tax that's being paid to pay for it, or largely for it. And this was weighing heavily on these smallholders out in the Western frontier who formed the foot soldiers to the regulator movement.
Well, that in a way brings us to May 1771. We have William Tryon not initially leaping to violence, but the regulator movement still pushing up against him. How did violence eventually break out into what we now call the Battle of Alamance?
Okay, well, Alamance is an area, if you like, in central North Carolina, and the regulators gathered to make a protest directly to the governor by going to Hillsborough, but they gathered in a field, and the governor thought, and they thought their numbers would impress upon the governor his need to step in and reorganize the government. And so they arrived there. Some say there was as many as 5,000 or 6,000, but we can safely say there was around 2,000, and they gathered there in this field near Alamance Township. And the governor marched out with about 1,100 militia. He was supposed to have about 1,500, but 400 of them got waylaid. But he arrives with 1,100 and marches fairly quickly to this field where the regulators had gathered. The regulators at this stage didn't imagine that the colonial militia would fire on them. But nevertheless, Tryon issued the Riot Act and asked people to disperse. And when they didn't, he sent in the troops and they fired a couple of volleys with their muskets. And then there was a kind of battle that went on for about an hour with people taking pot shots at the militia from behind trees. But very few people were actually killed. About 10 regulators were killed, similar number of militia. Tryon's men swept the field. They were all pretty much militia men as well. They weren't redcoats. They weren't regular soldiers.
So this is American colonists versus other American colonists.
That's right, yeah. So it becomes a really complicated picture, doesn't it?
Yeah, it certainly does. So after the battle, you say there were some killed, not huge numbers killed.
No.
What became of the movement? Were they essentially dispersed and their demands unmet?
Several were arrested, and there were six executions that were carried out of ringleaders or of prominent regulators. There were several militia officers who went over on the side of the regulators as well who were executed. There was two or three of them as well. But yeah, this is a colonial militia. I mean, and this is the thing about the North American colonies is that every state had a well-regulated militia. And the militia was there to do all kinds of things. A lot of the time in the Northeast, it was there to protect colonists against Native Americans. The further south you went, you had more slaves. The militia was there to largely protect the colonists, yes, from Native Americans, but also from slave revolt. They were a system of terror, and they were designed to scare the living hell out of any slave who tried to escape their plantation. So the militia was seen as an absolute necessity to maintain order in this frightening society. It is a slave society.
How do we get from here, 1771, a small skirmish in one of the more agricultural colonies and one of the more southern colonies, a long way from Pennsylvania and Boston and places like that, to only 4 years later, the beginning of the War of Independence?
Yeah, okay, so it's an interesting point. These little outbreaks, if you like, of disturbance. There were, as you pointed out, Boston and Philadelphia were hotbeds of political dissent. This was a very argumentative, very well-educated people. And the British government was handling the lead-up to the war really badly. They were introducing taxes and then repealing them. And gradually, in this turmoil, all of these little movements with all of their complaints gathered together to become a veritable force, if you like. And, you know, the British sent in troops to Boston. They closed the port of Boston, but then it was supported by people from other colonies who sent them food and so forth. You know, and so it's that countdown to the revolution. But it's important to understand that people didn't imagine a new country, the United States of America, until really quite late in the piece. And then it really wasn't accepted by a lot of people. But because the British are annoying everybody with their actions, and the war starts off as being, there's a kind of jubilation in Britain, but wiser heads, particularly military people, are more supportive of the Americans. And several generals and admirals didn't want to fight in America because they felt they were fighting other British people. And that was like a civil war that harkened back to the 1640s. And they didn't really like that. In fact, William Howe, the general, actually wrote that he supported the aims of the American colonists. And he's the man in charge of the British war effort. So it was a very contentious war.
Do you think there was a path that Britain could have taken, a more conciliatory path, that would have meant that America would not have broken? I know this is purely speculative. Or events like the Battle of Alamance, eventually what happened, was America on an inexorable path to independence?
Yes, I'd say so. The British could have... you see, the British were in a bind. And their empire was quite complex, especially in the Atlantic world. Most of the money was being made in the Caribbean at this time. And so that's really where their focus was, protecting places like Jamaica and Barbados and so forth. Those were the big slave islands, if you like. In North America, they could have been far more conciliatory and a little bit less tone deaf with the taxation, but they really needed to organize their empire a little bit. But I think they underestimated the strength of feeling amongst the colonists profoundly. You know, it's arguable if they hadn't introduced new taxes and just let them continue on their way, that they might have created a sort of mutual commonwealth. That was certainly something that was thought about even at the time. But the British government wanted to go in there and read the Riot Act with strength and strength and awe, or whatever the expression is.
Shock and awe. Yeah.
Shock and awe, that was it. And they thought they'd go in there with 20,000 troops, you know, lots of foreigners as well, you know, demonstrating the power of this great government and this great British Empire. And they arrived. And they put a lot of onus on loyalism. They thought that a lot of people would be loyal to them. And indeed, there were a lot of loyalists. And there were loyalist militia units that were created, and whole regiments in the army were made up of loyalists. And only 120,000 left at the end of the war. And that's quite a big figure, 120,000. But there were probably many more who quietly acceded to the new country, even if they didn't necessarily think that it would be a good thing. I mean, leaving your house and home and literally leaving the country as refugees is a big ask for a lot of people. Also, the patriots themselves, if you like, they had committees of safety, and they were arresting suspected loyalists. There was a big fear campaign. Being tarred and feathered often killed people. It was incredibly violent. Lots of people were beaten up and thrown from their homes. Houses were burned. All of suspected loyalists. So there was a huge amount of terror at a local level in the 1770s leading up to the war.
Well, it's a fascinating chapter in the road to independence, a small skirmish that has sort of been echoed throughout the world. I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Kit Candlin, historian of American history at the University of Newcastle.
Thank you. Pleasure.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.